from the Wings Archive.
Every woman who came out of the genocide immediately realized that they don't have the support they used to have.
In April of 2012, the United Nations held a series of events across the world with the theme of learning from the Rwandan genocide. Today on Wings, we'll hear from the founder of the Genocide Survivors Support Network about what Rwandan women have been doing to help each other rebuild the country and their own shattered lives.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
How did you survive?
How does one survive? Well, some of us who survived, you could only survive if somebody cared about you surviving. There are a lot of kind people, good people, who risk their own lives to save yours. A family hit me, and then when I was found there, they took me to another family. I also happened to negotiate with the killers to buy some more time, because they thought I had some knowledge that they could use, and sometimes because they really felt that they needed to eat well. But it was never about letting me leave. They will eventually kill you, but it was more whether they torture you with machete or they use the gun if you have money to pay.
Here's a brief reminder about the Rwandan genocide. In 1994, treaty negotiations between armed Tutsi exiles and the Hutu-led government were at an impasse when the president of Rwanda was killed by a surface-to-air missile. Immediately, Rwanda's prime minister launched a well-planned extermination campaign against the once-dominant Tutsi minority. He would later plead guilty of genocide before the UN's International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Inflamed by a massive propaganda effort, Hutu military and civilians slaughtered at least 800,000 Tutsi men, women, and children, along with Hutus who tried to protect them. Nearly 10% of Rwanda's population died. About 500,000 women and girls were raped, a crime that was later recognized as part of the genocide. But fewer women than men died. By the end of the 1994 genocide, 70% of Rwanda's population was female. They had to reorganize all of life, and they had to heal. That takes a long time. Eugenia Mukushimana contributes to the process through the Genocide Survivors Support Network. She talked to Sheila Dallas Katzman for Wings.
The organization was founded in 2010 as a result of realization that indeed there are survivors, even if it was 17 years later, who are still hurting very much. And sometimes we get the impression that when people leave their countries and they migrate, if you come here to America, all of a sudden your problems are over and you should be able to adjust very easily and go on with your life. But it's not the case, because they still suffer from the genocide, the losses they endured, but also from the traumas that have not been addressed really.
Right, and we're talking about Rwanda. How do they find you? Because you're based here in the United States, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes, survivors are a very small, tiny family. Isolation is a big part of what a lot of people are suffering from. So survivors have always been able to gravitate toward finding other survivors through word of mouth. Once they find a few survivors who have been able to manage relatively their experiences, they want to talk to you, they want to know how you are, where you are at, how you got there, and we start talk, because that's what we do.
You yourself is a survivor of the genocide. Would you talk a little bit about what it is like for you?
Being a survivor to me means that we got a second chance at life. There is always the before that we we miss greatly. Some of us who were old enough, I was 23, so I have a very good memory of what it was before when all these people who got killed were still alive. I have good memories of my family, my friends. But I also realize that most of the survivors I work with, they never got a chance to know their families that well. They never got a chance to really live life before becoming survivors. So there is a part of me that somehow feels like I am lucky because I was old enough, and therefore I should do more. But there's also the fact that I'm raising a teenage girl who was born during the genocide. I came out of it with more, I guess, motivation a little bit because I lost lives during the genocide, but I acquired one, additional one, during this same genocide.
You lost your family? Who did you lose in the... It sounds like a stupid question because you lose so many people, but...
You do. We really don't talk about numbers because it's hard to count. But I did lose my husband, my daughter's father. I lost my own father. I lost my sister. I lost my aunt, my uncle. So loss is something that is really a big part of who we are today.
What is the current situation now in Rwanda? Have they begun to rebuild their lives? Can you share some of that with us?
Well, one thing that we know of is that it's so much harder to repair what has been broken. It takes a more effort. I think in terms of where we are at in Rwanda today, people are managing, and they're managing really, they've tried so hard. I don't know that people can get it, but they have been trying just maybe to paint a picture. Imagine what it is or what it was for a child who lost his or her parent to the genocide and the siblings. And when it came time to go back to school, she returned to the same school she used to go to. Some of her classmates are missing, and she knows what happened to them. She is sitting in the same classroom with the children of the parent who murdered her own parent. And she goes to that school day in, day out. She does not fight with those kids. And she has to go on. It's something that is hard to explain. And sometimes people think that survivors are harboring revenge feelings and things like that. It's not what the case is. A big part of surviving is focusing on yourself and trying to rebuild your life. I didn't have any room to focus on people who have killed my own people. There was no room in my day. You know, there's so much other things that I have to do. I have to find the people who were killed. We don't know where the remains are. I have to find out what happened to my friends. How many friends do I still have? Do I have enough food tomorrow or tonight? Am I going to be able to find school for my daughter? So it is really, it is very difficult to try to manage that crisis, your own crisis, and try to take on the other side of what justice looks like and what other people have done. But of course it's part of who you are, because inside you there are two people. There is the person who was there, is broken. There is the other person who looks at life and say, you know, why me? So you have to be able to balance.
You use the word broken quite a bit, and while you're saying broken, but with what you're saying, it sounds like shattered. Am I right in this analogy?
You are. Our lives become more of a mosaic. In the aftermath, it will take a different image, maybe, you know, and sometimes we just have to learn to be comfortable with whatever image we can make of that life, and accept the fact that some pieces will not be complete as they were before. You can't really get the whole thing back, but you try to create a new mosaic, a new life.
On Wings, you are listening to Patrika Dallas interviewing Eugenia Mukeshimana. The abruptly changed demographic of Rwanda led to a new constitution guaranteeing equal rights for women and reserving them 30% of seats in parliament. As of 2011, women held 56.3% of seats in the Chamber of Deputies, famously making Rwanda's the only parliament in the world where women are more than 50%. But parliament is a very small job pool.
I remember by the time the genocide was over, I ran into two women, and they were running this organization called AVEGA, and which is an association for all genocide widows. So I was there because I was one of them. And we were laughing and trying to make sense of what has happened to us and what we were supposed to do. Every woman who came out of the genocide immediately realized that they don't have the support they used to have, whether it's support from your father, your brothers, your uncles, your husband. The gender roles were very distinct in Rwanda. So we had to pick up the pieces and do what we had to do to feed our families. So you saw a lot of women who got into business. They didn't know how to run the business because their husbands used to run the business. Many of them didn't know whether the house they lived in was paid off or was still a loan. But we took the time to ask the questions, to learn how is this done. They talked to other women. We went to the extent of trying to find out exactly what is it that we can get so that we can be successful, because we didn't have a room for errors, basically. What we see today in Rwanda is a result of the resiliency of women, the women who wanted to do better because they did not want their children growing up wondering what life would have been if the father was there.
It's interesting. Women become entrepreneurs. They didn't even know if their houses were paid for. Mm-hmm. So they have to ask questions. But who do you ask when you don't know who is who?
Well, women talk to other women, and it turns out they're very smart. If you knew one woman who was in business, she didn't have to be your friend. As long as somebody pointed out what that woman was in business before, she might know something that you don't know. So you went over to her and say, I want to talk to you. And they would sit down and talk to you. It was a bond that was developed among women, and we wanted to do well, and it was important for us because part of what happens with survivors is that you only truly feel that life is beginning to take shape again if you have some control over your means of living. If you have a job, if you can feed your kids, and then you can begin thinking about building the house and investing in something else. So it was important for us to make that statement somehow that yes, we are women, we are widows, but we can do it. We can do it.
Widows, you can do it.
From the Wings Archive, you are listening to Eugenia Mukeshimana, founder of the Rwandan Genocide Survivors Support Network. She spoke to Sheila Dallas-Katzman in 2012.
You said in your presentation at the UNNGO meeting on Rwanda to commemorate the genocide that people sometimes live next door to perpetrators. How do they deal with this? How do they know they're perpetrators? And how do perpetrators know that?
Because these people knew each other before the genocide happened. They used to, that's where they lived, and they know exactly what each person has done during the genocide.
And the victims, survivors?
A lot of survivors, they're hoping that the future is brighter. If you are the only survivor in your family, and you know that if you don't survive, the family is gone, all of it, you will do whatever it takes to make sure that you're safe.
And who has more fear now to make sure that they're safe? Both people are securing themselves, right? So the perpetrator is afraid, have some form of fear. But they're all survivors when you think of it. Am I right?
Yeah, except that the level of fear is different. One is fearing justice, and that justice only involved going to jail. The other person is fearing death, which will mean the end of their lives as they know it, the end of the line for the family. It's different. And part of it, and this is not widespread, but it is not something that can be ruled out because it had happened before, that some perpetrators have unfortunately came out and went after the survivor who got away from them in the first place, because that survivor is a witness to the crime they have committed. See, the crime doesn't die off, you know. The crime lives on forever. It's a stain that is permanent. And if at some point the fact that there is a survivor who is alive, who escaped, who they thought was dead but didn't die, it doesn't sit well with many perpetrators.
Is it a fact that the Rwandese government has forbidden anyone to talk about the genocide openly or something?
It hasn't forbidden people to talk about the genocide openly. However, it is very strict about the continuation of the ideology of pulling people apart, of the continuation of what made this genocide possible, that people can demonize other people just because they are part of this ethnic group. And in doing so, the only thing they have done was to eliminate the mention of your ethnicity in documents, because not only that identity card that said you were Hutu or Tutsi could save you or kill you during the genocide, but also you have to remember that throughout the years, that mention prevented people, Tutsis, from going to schools, from getting some jobs, from being able to travel, from having access to some businesses, because people didn't have to see your face.
You mentioned that this was the instigation of some British person, that the for one to understand the genocide in Rwanda, they have to look at the history of how it came about. Would you quickly tell us a little bit about that?
It's a guy named John Henning Speke, I think that's his name. So he wrote a book in the late 1800s. And in his famous book, he mentioned that the Tutsis were not like regular Africans. They had more European blood in them. They were tall. They had a nose that looks like they were descended of Europeans. And therefore, they're more intelligent than the rest of the people that he found in the region. They were more organized than other people. So he painted this picture of Tutsis being the alien, the offsprings of white people, European white people, or maybe Egyptian. And what the elite, educated, extremist Hutus did with that writing from the late 1800s, they took it and used it and said, you see, they are not from here. They are not like us. They think they're better than us. You know, we don't want them here, and therefore we're going to send them back where they came from, back to Ethiopia and through the rivers. And sure enough, during the genocide, that's what they did. They throw them in the rivers and send them back to Ethiopia, supposedly, because they were aliens.
Are you saying they They throw the bodies of the people they slaughtered in the rivers?
No, they tied their hands in the back so they couldn't swim. And they know the river is infested with crocodiles. There's no way that somebody would survive. That's what they did. But the person who used that as a propaganda knew very well that this British guy didn't know anything about Rwanda, hasn't done any research. I don't even think that he spoke the language. It's just observation. You know, can I go today to the in the Amazon and try to write anything about them? No. But that's how you harm people even long after you have gone, you have left, because you have did a disservice to humanity by coming up with these kind of writings that are very harmful, because someone else will pick on what you said and run with it and do something horrible with it. Everyone inside Rwanda is hurting one way or the other. I know some Hutus who did not participate, and I don't think that happy that their cousins or their uncles committed terrible, terrible crimes. Even for the Hutus who participated, I don't think they're very comfortable with it either.
How can people out there in the international community help?
When you look to work in the help of society in the aftermath of a terrible tragedy like a genocide, I think it's very important that you really take time to get to know the people. Like I said at the UN presentation, there wasn't any program whatsoever right after the genocide that people were looking for anyone who might have survived. There are lives that could have been saved if somebody was really focusing on that particular population. But even after, as we moved away from emergency programs to more development programs, it's not right that somebody comes in with their own imagination of what people need. People know their land better. They know the where they live better. They know their needs better. You can go to a community and ask them what they have, what they would like to see happen, and you can fit in that, and you can help them achieve that. We want programs that actually have long-lasting results. And the international community has a tendency to stay away from the big programs, like education. Education is one of them. A lot of organizations don't see education as an emergency or as a development program. So there is a disconnect. There is also another issue that I see, that is providing information to people. Information is something that is very valuable. The women in Rwanda knew how to weave those baskets that we love so much now. But they didn't know that those baskets were valuable. Somebody could use them. So it's very important that these people start to look into ways to help the communities that provide information that will make someone have almost like a paradigm shift. And that's what I mean by information being available to people. A lot of communities are very isolated, and that isolation makes it difficult for them even to dream bigger. I think if people can be educated, if people in Rwanda can learn about a program, what the women in Zambia are doing, what women in Nigeria are doing, how women in Ethiopia run businesses, if they can learn how childcare issues are resolved in Kenya, for example, if they can learn just different practical means that others are using to better their lives. You find there is a disconnect that I know how things work in Rwanda. I know what we do with even our skincare. We're women. We care about that. But, you know, yeah, if I'm sure if women in Rwanda knew that shea butter was very good for your skin, and that they could get it in Tanzania, they wouldn't be buying all these crazy lotions full of, you know, harmful chemicals from imported from God knows where. So there is that information that is lacking, and I think it will really make women's life and everybody's life actually much better. Going back to the Rwanda and reconstruction, what made Rwanda very, very successful is also one thing, is the fact that we had policies that work, is the fact that we had people who had come from different places, and they brought different ideas. And that's why you see that people began to see to look at business differently, to come up with different type of way of doing things. And if you look at the weddings before, the way they were done before, it's completely different now. If you look at the kinds of services, even public transportation, which is not, yes, it is public transportation, but it's not funded by the government. You know, somebody got an idea from somewhere. Information is everything when it comes to development.
I want to thank you. Do you have a message for your own people in Rwanda?
I just want to let them know that I'm very proud of their hard work. We're not complacent people. We know we can do far more than we have done. We also not very, we are very aware of the difficulties that some of them are facing in terms of being able to move forward. There is still a great need, but we can do it as long as we stick together and work together.
You've just listened to Eugenie Mukeshimana of Rwanda, and her organization is
Genocide Survivors Support Network.
Eugenia Mukeshimana took part in United Nations activities in 2012 to mark the 18th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. She was interviewed in New York by Sheila Dallas Katzman. As of April 2012, the UN's International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda had sentenced 27 leaders. One of the cases is that of Rwanda's former Minister for Family and Women Affairs, the first woman in the world convicted of genocide. She and her son were found guilty of abducting hundreds of people and of ordering assaults, rapes, and murders. The Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda is charged with winding up its activities during 2012, but there are negotiations for pending cases to be transferred to national courts in various countries. The tribunal has also negotiated with 5 countries to house the convicted in their national prisons. Many of these prisoners have been sentenced for life. This has been a Wings Archival production. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. You can find recent programs available for download on our new website, wingsradio.org. And we have a daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frida Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.